This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9 a.m. Coming up next. On Political Perspectives, we feature two talks given in April at PeaceWorks 2014, featuring Nora Ericott and Angela Davis. But first, this.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 13th annual Explorando on Saturday, June 14th at Whitaker Ponds Nature Park from 1 to 5 p.m. Explorando will feature live music, folkloric dances, guided canoe trips, hands-on environmental activities by rock climbing wall, and more! Explorando gives people the opportunity to learn about the importance of preserving the nature of the Columbia Slough. Again, that's Explorando, June 14th at Whitaker Ponds Nature Park from 1 to 5 p.m. More information can be found on kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Free 'Em All, a benefit to support political prisoners, on Saturday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Memorial Ballroom. Free 'Em All is an evening of music, dance, spoken word, and political remix, featuring David Rovex, international folk singer-songwriter, and emceed by KBOO's own Mike Crenshaw. Again, that's Free 'Em All, a benefit to support political prisoners on Saturday, June 14th, 7 p.m. at Portland State University Smith Memorial Ballroom. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Today on Political Perspectives, we feature two talks given in April at PeaceWorks 2014 at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. The title of the conference was Yet Again as Captives, Mass Incarceration in the U.S. and Palestine, sponsored by the Rachel Corrie Foundation. The speakers are Nora Ericott and Angela Davis. First, we hear Nora Ericott, a teaching fellow at Temple University Beasley School of Law and Badil's U.S.-based legacy advocacy coordinator. Nora is a co-editor of Jadalaya.com.
Since 1967, Israel has incarcerated 800,000 Palestinians, no less than 20% of the Palestinian population limited to the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Today, in captivity, there are 5,224 Palestinians, including 21 women, 83 administrative detainees, and 210 children, 34 of whom are under the age of 16, and notably, Israel considers that Palestinian children can include those up to the age of 18, unlike the application of its own laws to its Israeli children. Among Palestinians, jail is a very normalized part of life, as normal and as common as school, as babies, as olive oil and thyme. There is no stigma to it, because the crimes for which Palestinians are locked up in cold, distant cells are crimes of resistance. Resistance to oppression, to subjugation, to humiliation, and the degradation of land and family. To Palestinians, they are all political prisoners, and they are prisoners for whom we sing songs. Min sijn Akka, tula'at janazi. Muhammad Jamjoum Ufuad Hijazi. Jazi alayhum ya sha'bi jazi. Mandoub Issami Urab'o Umuma. The funeral procession set out from Akka prison for Muhammad Jamjoum and Fuad Hijazi. Oh, how they punish them, my people. Oh, how the High Commissioner and his people punish them. This is a chorus for a song dedicated to three Palestinian martyrs resisting British and Zionist colonial domination in the 1930s. It's a gruesome story that's been romanticized and encapsulates the Palestinian condition. Palestinians know that the criminal system is an unjust system, and we must know that too. We cannot take the criminal system at face value. Our prisons, from Palestine to Saudi Arabia to China and the United States, are not filled with bad people who have done bad things. Criminal law, more than any other type of law, represents the moral compass of society. And rather than punishing what causes the greatest harm to society, it punishes what society considers the most abhorrent. That's why, across 14 states, including Texas, Idaho, Oklahoma, and Virginia, sodomy was illegal until 2003. And meanwhile, in California, same-sex marriage became legal as early as 2008. That's why in Ann Arbor, Michigan, you can walk around and smoke a joint publicly. But in Louisiana, you can be imprisoned for up to 20 years for mere possession of marijuana. Criminal law does not represent what will harm us most. Criminal law represents what is the greatest risk to those in power. And for Palestinians, those in power represent an ethos of settler colonialism. Upon its establishment, Israel passed a series of laws that privileged its Jewish inhabitants and further dispossessed and marginalized its non-Jewish, indigenous, Christian, and Palestinian population. The Citizenship Law of 1952 and the Law of Return of 1950 ensured that Jewish persons who lived beyond Israel's boundaries and had no relationship to it had more rights than the state's own Palestinian citizens. The new state was cementing its Jewish demographic majority that its Zionist founders thought necessary to preserve Israel's Jewish character. By instituting a series of similar laws, it also preserved Jewish political, social, and economic privilege. The purpose of these laws has been to ensure that Palestinians are a minority, an underclass, and a fragmented population within its society. Israel's policies aim to diminish the Palestinian population, to geographically concentrate them into separated ghettos, and to erase their presence physically and metaphysically in an effort to uphold a national mythology regarding its establishment and existence. Between 1948 and 1966, Israel imposed emergency laws within its non-declared borders. Israel has never declared its borders to this day. That's why saying the 1967 borders is so blasphemous. So it's non-declared borders, and it imposed emergency law upon its Arab citizens, the 100,000 Palestinians who didn't flee in the course of Plan Dalit or the 1948 war, the Palestinian Nakba, the Palestinian population who now constitute approximately 1.3 million of Israel's population, or 20% of its population, not including those in the West Bank and Gaza. It imposed this emergency law, which is the law that allows a government to conduct itself by force rather than consent. It imposed it upon its non-Jewish citizens only, up until 1966, because it prepared for the imposition of that law upon the Palestinian population in the occupied territories in 1967 to this present day. This emergency law is derivative of a British colonial administration. Historically, the British Empire applied emergency law to suppress rebellion and self-determination amongst native peoples from Kenya to Malaya to British Guyana and Mandate Palestine. And while other countries like Egypt and Syria have applied emergency law for decades, the moniker for the longest lasting imposition of this law goes to the only democracy in the Middle East. A matrix of 1,500 military laws exist in the occupied territories. They can be changed arbitrarily, without notice, applied retroactively, in violation of the most basic tenet of criminal law, nullum crimen sine lege, or no crime and no punishment where there was no applicable law prohibiting it. But this does not matter to Israel, where the law is designed to further settler colonial expansion. Thus, it is illegal for Palestinians to drive on Israeli-only roads. It is illegal to build homes without permits that are systematically denied. It is illegal to commemorate the Nakba within Israel. It is illegal to build ties with Palestinians and Arab throughout the surrounding Middle East and Arab world, as was just the case with 23-year-old journalist Majid Kayali, who has been charged with treason, given a gag order, and now held under house arrest. It is illegal for Palestinians from Gaza to study at Bir Zeit University, Najah University, Abu Dis University in the West Bank because of an infiltrator's law. It is illegal to go fishing beyond 3 nautical miles off of the Gaza coast, where fishermen would fish to feed their families and to have a livelihood, in contravention of basic human rights, as well as the 2012 ceasefire agreement. It is illegal for Palestinian citizens of Israel to marry a Palestinian from so-called enemy states, including the West Bank, Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and to live, to acquire a residency for them in their homes of Haifa, Yaffa, Akka, Safad, Bisan, Tarshiha, Umm al-Fahm, and the rest of Israel and its non-declared borders. It is illegal to worship as a Muslim in the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem if you are not among the few who have Jerusalemite ID or Israeli citizenship. It is illegal to reach the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, as Palestinian Christians have been denied that right this weekend, this Easter, in the last 9 Easters, and in every day of their lives this year and in the indefinite years to come. Given Israel's desire to control the most land with the least Palestinians, together with its arbitrary matrix of military and discriminatory law, the question is not why so many Palestinians, 800,000 since 1967, have been held in captivity, but why so many have not. And the truth is that they are all held in captivity, being denied self-determination and the right to choose freely one's own economic, cultural, social, and political future is being held in captivity, whether in the open-air prison on the Gaza Strip, whether in forced exile throughout the 58 refugee camps in the Arab world and in the global diaspora, or whether as impediments to Israel's hegemony the world over. Israeli prison cells are simply one and amongst the most visceral of this multi-layered captivity. In the U.S., where settler colonialism is ongoing and where we have yet to mourn the institution of slavery as a nation and to issue even nominal monetary reparations for those crimes against humanity, our criminal system is no different. Our laws criminalize poverty, and our police forces disproportionately patrol communities of color. Of course, communities of color will be disproportionately represented in prisons when that's where we place our police. Of course, Muslims and Arabs will be subject to FBI investigations of terrorism when that's who the FBI targets. Over the last 30 years, the U.S. penal population has risen from approximately 300,000 to over 2 million, the majority of which consists of drug convictions. 3/4 of all people imprisoned for drug offenses are Black and Latino, despite the majority of drug users and dealers being white. Native Americans only constitute 1.2% of the U.S.'s population, and yet are incarcerated at a rate of 38% greater than the national average. In 2010, African Americans, who are systematically excluded from the formal labor market, had the highest poverty rate in over half a century. 27.4% of African Americans made less than $11,139 a year. That is criminal. And yet, one out of every 15 African American males is locked up in prison in comparison to one out of every 106 white Americans. And this, by the way, is to say nothing of the way that we criminalize our immigrant population, who suffer both for economic and national vulnerability. But these laws do not simply punish certain populations, they dehumanize them. In February 2012, a young unarmed boy was fatally gunned down. In July 2013, a jury acquitted his shooter, citing that he had the right to self-defense. The judgment makes no sense. 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was unarmed, save for a bag of Skittles. Its most deadly ingredient was its high fructose corn syrup. But the jury agreed that George Zimmerman experienced reasonable fear at the sight of a black child in a hoodie. A reasonable enough fear to use a lethal weapon to fatally shoot this boy at close proximity. And in this tragedy, we learned again and were reminded again that self-defense doesn't belong to everybody. That the right to victimhood is an exclusive right that doesn't belong to everybody. Last summer, I co-led an interfaith peace builders delegation. You should all join one. Where we met David Wilder, head of the Hebron Settlement Council and a U.S.-born Jewish man from Cleveland. Hebron, if you don't know, El Khalil, is the site of the most extreme forms of tangible violence. The settler movement began to colonize it in 1967 in what they regard as their homecoming. They're ideologically motivated and are more committed to being on the land, which they believe belongs to them by divine decree, than they are to the state of Israel. And unlike other settlements which are built on hilltops so that settlers and the army can surveil Palestinians, in Hebron, the settlement is built straight in the middle of the Palestinian community, creating a donut hole, terrorizing the Palestinians who live there. In response to a question about Baruch Goldstein, the Israeli settler who killed 29 Palestinians as they prayed at the Ibrahimi Mosque in 1994, David explained, quote, "You can count on one or two hands the Jews who have used violence that was not in self-defense." In contrast, Isa Amro, a Palestinian youth leader of Youth Against Settlements, like all other Palestinians, does not have a state, does not have an international force, does not have an army, does not have weapons, does not have anyone to protect him. Settlers physically assault, spit on, and expose themselves to Isa Amro and children and Palestinians in El Khalil as Israeli soldiers watch on. The army does intervene, but only if Palestinians react in any way. Then the soldiers detain the Palestinians and not the settlers. Isa explains, quote, "I am a nonviolent activist, but I believe in defending myself. The problem is that I cannot." Isa is not eligible to experience reasonable fear. He will never be able to exercise self-defense under the current matrix of law. He is always the looming threat. Amongst Americans, and certainly those in the Beltway, where I've lived, unfortunately, for a long time, this couldn't be farther from the truth. Let me tell you a little bit more about the conditions of settler violence, which is not prosecuted. There's an average of one attack by settlers on Palestinians every day. In 2013, there were 399 attacks. On November 14th, 2013, in one of the most gruesome attacks, at 2 a.m., two settler men approached the home of Ruwaida and Khalid Dar Khalil, where they slept with their five children. The settler men poured gasoline onto the porch and threw a Molotov cocktail through the window. They firebombed the home. The fire blocked the door, and the entire family had to rush to the rooftop to obtain shelter. They survived, as the Palestinian Fire Department did come, but those settler men have never been prosecuted for that crime. And in fact, that's the norm. In the past 10 years, the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel documented 700 complaints by Palestinians about settler violence. And of those 700 complaints, 700 went without a criminal investigation. There is impunity that's afforded by the state for these settlers to attack. And in fact, soldiers stand idly by until Palestinians attacked, and then they are incarcerated. But Israeli troops don't even need a reason to incarcerate Palestinians. Under the military law I spoke of, Israel can arbitrarily detain Palestinians, imprison them for up to 6 months without charge or trial, renewable every 6 months indefinitely. Imagine the denial of habeas corpus that we've protested vehemently in Guantanamo Bay. Imagine that that's applied to Palestinians for over 60 years. In the case of Iyad Boudin, he has been imprisoned for up to nearly five years now, his sentence renewed 30 times. 183 Palestinians are in administrative detention today. And the reason they're detained without charge or trial is not because they've done something wrong, but because they become subjects of interrogation. Interrogation where Israel practices torture systematically. Since 1967, Israel has tortured to death 73 Palestinians in its custody. The most recent among these was Arafat Jaradat, a 30-year-old man who wasn't incarcerated for more than 70 days before he died as a result of torture. Israel doesn't even bother to use the euphemism enhanced interrogation techniques. It says we torture in the name of national security, and national security specifically for its Jewish citizens. And after 66 years of ongoing Israeli subjugation, the risk of accepting these conditions as natural is severely high. Doing so would accept Israel's national security narrative and reify the absurd human rights atrocities that plague Palestinians in particular and all of humanity in general. But Palestinians have not waited for anyone to save them. Palestinian political prisoners in April 2012 used the one thing they had at their disposal to resist this condition. They used their own bodies in a massive hunger strike. On April 17, 2012, 2,500 Palestinian political prisoners engaged in a massive hunger strike. They asked for the most basic things: the right to a higher education, the right to medical care, the right to family visits, the right to purchase items from canteens, the right to know what the charges against them were or to be released. Fa'ir Halahle was one of these hunger strikers. On his 73rd day of his hunger strike, his gums and his lips were bleeding. He reached 121 pounds. 4 days later, the Israeli prison authorities let him out. But during his captivity, he wrote a letter to his one-year-old daughter who he had not met yet. And he wrote, "My beloved Lamar, forgive me because the occupation took me away from you and from the pleasure of witnessing my firstborn child that I have always prayed to God to see, to kiss, to be happy with. It is not your fault. This is our destiny as Palestinian people to have our lives and the lives of our children taken away from us. Lamar, my love, that day will come when I am free and I will make it up to you for everything and tell you the whole story, and your days that will follow will be more beautiful. So let your days pass now and wear your prettiest clothes. Run and then run again in the gardens of your long life. Go forward and forward, for nothing is behind you but the past. And this is your voice I hear all the time as a melody of freedom." Israel rearrested Tha'ir. I'll clap for him as well, yes. Israeli officials rearrested Tha'ir on April 10th, 2013. This is his eighth time in prison. He's spent 6.5 years now in captivity. Not a single charge filed against him. But this is common practice. For all the talk that we've been hearing about prisoner release in this current peace process, Israel can release and rearrest Palestinians at will. That's what an occupying force can do. That's what an apartheid regime can do. Palestinians can't arrest a single Israeli, certainly can't arrest the settlers that attack them, certainly can't protect themselves against those who harm them. Since 1967 and 1993 and 2013, so between the start of the peace process and last year, Israel released about 26,000 Palestinian political prisoners as a gesture of goodwill and has rearrested 86,000 in that same period. Palestinians will continue to resist as they have resisted and as they have inspired us. But the truth is, even when they're released from their cold, distant, concrete prison cells, released back into their homes in Ramallah and Nablus, in Gaza City, in Rafah, they are still not free. No Palestinian will be free until the entirety of this apartheid regime is dismantled. And Palestinians are certainly committed to this, and I've asked you all to commit with them as well in their 2005 call for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israeli apartheid, settler colonialism, and occupation. And most relevant to this discussion is the target of G4S, a private security company that profits off of the incarceration of every additional person, from Palestine to Australia to Brazil and beyond. G4S, our bodies are their bottom line. And so the campaign now is against them. And only 2 days ago, the Boycott National Committee has asked, especially those in the United States, especially you, to press on the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which owns $170 million worth of stock in G4S, to divest their holdings, to divest those holdings. So I urge you all to answer that call, to join that campaign, to sing along to the melody of Tha'ir's daughter, Lamar. I urge you all to raise your voices in freedom. Let's free all of our political prisoners at home. Let's free ourselves from corporate greed and domination. Let's free our people who should have never been locked up. And let's free Palestine. Thank you. Thank you. Don't worry, I'm not going to keep talking. I'm up here to introduce the one and only Miss Angela Davis, who are all waiting in anticipation to hear. That was the hardest talk to give because I knew I wanted to get through it so I can hear you. Through her activism and scholarship over many decades, Angela Davis has been deeply involved in movements for social justice around the world. Her work as an educator, both at the university level and in the larger public sphere, has always emphasized the importance of building communities of struggle for economic, racial, and gender justice. Angela is now Distinguished Professor Emerita of History of Consciousness, an interdisciplinary PhD program, and of Feminist Studies. She is the author of 9 books and has lectured throughout the United States, as well as in Europe, Africa, Asia, Australia, and South America. She draws upon her own experiences in the early 70s as a person who spent 18 months in jail and on trial after being placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Her recent books include Abolition Democracy and Are Prisons Obsolete? In 2012, she published a new collection of essays entitled The Meaning of Freedom. Angela Davis is the founding member of Critical Resistance, a national organization dedicated to the dismantling of the prison industrial complex. Internationally, she is affiliated with Sisters Inside, an abolitionist organization based in Queensland, Australia, that works in solidarity with women in prison. Please help me welcome Miss Angela Davis.
Thank you, Noura. You're a hard act to follow yourself. Thank you so much for the wonderful presentation. I cannot tell you what an honor it is to have been invited to participate in the Rachel Corey Foundation 2014 Peace Works Conference. For many years, I have been inspired by the courage of Rachel Corey. I have followed the work of Cindy and Craig Corey and have been inspired by their determination to engage in and promote the kind of grassroots and arts activism that will engrave the memory of Rachel Corey on the hearts of people all over the world. But let me say that this kind of gathering, this conference, this theme is precisely what we need at this moment to make it possible for progressive people in this country to seriously talk about and act against the occupation of Palestine and to place the carceral practices of the State of Israel within the context of the global prison industrial complex, which means that when we talk about mass incarceration in the U.S., we need to be able to explore the connections with the mass political incarceration of Palestinians by the State of Israel. Of course, we know that if it were not for the aid provided by the U.S. to the tune of some $3 billion a year, the occupation could not continue. The U.S. provides what amounts to over one-fifth of Israel's entire military budget. So certainly, before we even begin to explore the intersections between the two countries' practices of mass incarceration, we see how deeply the U.S. is implicated in the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Why do so many people assume that the government of Israel must be considered immune to substantive critique? And of course, it is because of the emotional connection people are urged to make between the Holocaust and Israel as the only viable haven for Jews. It's often assumed that we cannot say never again without supporting Israel. But the violence that claimed the lives of so many Jews during the Holocaust is not unrelated to racist violence, to settler colonial violence in the U.S., in South Africa, in Australia, in Europe. And it seems to me that just as we claim the right to stand up to governments all over the world, and just as we claim the right to stand up to the U.S. government, even, and perhaps especially the United States government of the Obama era, we should join increasing numbers of Israeli citizens, Jewish and Arab, in standing up to the State of Israel. As Nora pointed out, something like 800,000 Palestinians have been subjected to imprisonment since 1967. If we look at the United States, we can see that there are almost 2.5 million people in U.S. state and federal prisons, but we add to the prisons also the county jails and the military prisons and the jails in Indian country and also the immigrant detention centers. Michelle Alexander has pointed out that there are more black men in prison and under the direct control of correctional agencies today, in the second decade of the 21st century, than there were enslaved in 1850. In the U.S., of course, here in this country, we tend to separate political prisoners from the vast numbers of prisoners whose bodies constitute fuel for profit for the prison industrial complex. I can tell you that many years ago, when I was arrested, and that was before a lot of you were born, it was in 1970, what we attempted to do was to trouble that what appeared to be a distinction that was too clear between political prisoners and criminals, right? Of course, I was considered a political prisoner, even though I was arrested on 3 criminal charges. I was charged with murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy, all of which were capital charges at the time. So I was charged with the death penalty three times, you know, which is really bizarre that they think they can send you to what was at that time the gas chamber three times. But at that time, there were many other political prisoners, some of whose names you may recognize. Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, Erica Huggins, other members of the Black Panther Party, young people who were involved in Latino organizations such as the Young Lords or the Brown Berets. There was the campaign on the West Coast, for example, around Los Siete de la Raza. And I should point out that there are people who are still in prison from that era. As a matter of fact, my co-defendant, Rochelle McGee, observed the 50th anniversary of his imprisonment as we were observing the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation and the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and the Birmingham campaign, etc. Mondo Waylonga, David Poindexter, Veronzo Bowers, and of course Leonard Peltier, who was one of the longest held political prisoners in this country. And then Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was arrested later, but has still spent decades of his life on death row before he was recently placed in the main population. During the era of the 70s, we began to think about the connection between political prisoners, those who were arrested for having been involved in political acts or because of their political affiliation, the connection between political prisoners and those who were politicized while they were in prison and therefore came to be subjected to yet another level of repression. George Jackson, for example, the Soledad brothers are good examples of the ways in which people who were considered to be criminals became politicized. And then thanks to the ways in which prisoners like George Jackson began to analyze the situation of people in prison at that time, we came to recognize that most people in prison were there because of the racist and political function of the criminal justice system. The best example of the what we might call the structural racism of the criminal justice system, and Noura already referred to that, are the racial disparities in drug arrests and drug convictions and drug sentencing. According to the NAACP, five times as many white people use drugs as black people. Yet black people are sent to prison for drug offenses at 10 times the rate of white people. African Americans represent 12% of the total population of drug users, which is about the population, the percentage of the main population. But 38% of those arrested for drug offenses and 59% of those in state prison for a drug offense. African Americans serve virtually as much time in prison for a drug offense, 58.7 months, this is the NAACP still, as whites do for a violent offense, which is 61.7 months. Now, this racial disparity represents an example of the structural racism that is a political feature that pervades the criminal justice system from the level of law enforcement to correctional agencies. So even those who are not labeled political prisoners, rather, are for the most part in prison because of a set of political conditions that are responsible for the continued existence of racist strategies and ideologies. As Frederick Douglass said many, many years ago, crime is imputed to color. He was referring then to the criminalization of slaves and then former slaves. If we kind of fast forward to the present and we think about the emergence of what we call a prison industrial complex as the consequence of the privatization of human resources and the deindustrialization of the economy and the dismantling of the welfare state, one can say that the incarceration of so many youth of color in this country is a dramatic indication of the failure of U.S. society. Instead of encouraging young Black, Latino, Native American people, this is actually true of poor youth of all racial and national backgrounds, instead of encouraging them to dream of a democratic future, they stamp them as surplus populations. They are not needed. So there will be no schools for them. Or if there are schools, there will be schools that emphasize punishment, discipline and punishment, and testing. Testing is a part of the discipline punishment process. Prison is a fact of life for many people. People here in the U.S., and especially Black people, Latinos, Native and Asian American communities targeted by police, poor white people as well, can identify this process of criminalization. Virtually, I think probably almost every Black person in this country, even someone like Clarence Thomas, the ones who Martin Luther King said had climbed out of the swamps on the shoulders of their sisters and brothers and failed to look back and failed to realize how they got out of the swamp in the first place. Even they have direct or indirect connections to prison, a family member, a friend who has been in prison. Here in the U.S., with 2.5 million people behind bars, it has never occurred to us to have a prisoner's day. I mean, I think we can learn so much from the Palestinian struggle. Of course, in Palestine, virtually every prisoner in an Israeli jail is a political prisoner. And the small minority who might not be arrested for explicitly political acts quickly become political once they meet their brothers and sisters behind bars. As much as Israel would like to pretend that the occupation of Palestine is working well, the numbers of prisoners indicate that the occupation can only be managed by means of violence and repression. When I traveled to Palestine in the summer of 2011 with a delegation of women of color and indigenous feminist scholar activists, it was actually the first trip for all of us. But all of us had been involved for many years in Palestine solidarity work. We were all totally shocked by the egregious and visible nature of the repression. The Israeli military made no attempt to conceal or mitigate the violence they were inflicting on Palestinian people. Gun-toting military men and women were everywhere. I remember saying that I was in South Africa before the downfall of apartheid. I didn't violate the boycott. I was invited by the ANC to come. And I also had traveled to Northern Ireland at one of the most difficult periods. And I said that neither place was as bad as what I witnessed in occupied Palestine. On our delegation, there were people who had grown up in South Africa and people who had grown up on Indian reservations, people who had grown up in the Jim Crow South, and everybody had exactly the same reaction. The wall, you know, the concrete, the razor wire, those are the technologies of imprisonment that is transferred from the prison to the larger community. I still cannot get the image of these young Israeli kids walking around with these huge weapons with their fingers on the trigger all the time. It was really scary. In Hebron, also walking through the marketplace and looking up and seeing an Israeli soldier with his gun aimed directly at you. We could not help expressing absolute shock that we had not realized that in so many respects it was worse than South African apartheid, worse than Jim Crow racism. We realized that the carceral technologies that we have seen in maximum and super maximum security prisons here in the U.S. were very much at use in the so-called free world, which was clearly not free. Virtually everyone we met had either been in prison or had family members and friends who had been in prison. How many Palestinians have been arrested since the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza began in 1967? Between 750,000 and 1 million. And that's 20% of the population, 40% of the male population. That is why virtually everyone has a direct connection to someone in prison or who has been in prison. And this is also why I believe Palestinians have such great respect, those behind bars. Because historically, much of the leadership of the resistance has come from prison. I think we here in the U.S. can learn a great deal from our sisters and brothers in Palestine. We can learn from their dedication, from their perseverance, from their optimism. We can learn from their belief in the power of education. I was so totally impressed to learn that the literacy rate is over 90%. Even though the Israeli prison service, education and liberation are inseparable. The Palestinians know this better than anyone else. And I think we here in the U.S. need to relearn that lesson about the connection between education and liberation. I want to follow what Noura pointed to and spend a few minutes talking about G4S, because this is an important campaign. And we know that there are quite a number of transnational corporations that have been identified as targets of the boycott. Veolia, for example. Don't use Super Shuttle anymore. And of course, as a result of, who was it, Scarlett Johansson, we know about SodaStream, right? And then there's Boeing and Hewlett Packard, and of course there's Caterpillar, because Caterpillar, whose products are used by the Israeli military, we will never forget that it was a militarized Caterpillar bulldozer that took the life of Rachel Corrie. G4S is especially important because it participates directly in the maintenance and reproduction of repressive apparatuses in Palestine. So we're talking about prisons, checkpoints, the apartheid wall. G4S represents the growing insistence on what is called security under the neoliberal state. And the ideologies of security that bolster not only privatization of security, but the privatization of imprisonment and the privatization of warfare. It is responsible, G4S is responsible for the repressive treatment of political prisoners inside Israel. G4S is the largest security corporation in the world. It's also the third largest private corporation in the world. You know the first one, right? What is the largest private corporation in the world? Walmart. What's the second one? Foxconn. Absolutely right. And what's the third one? G4S. G4S has insinuated itself into our lives under the guise of security and the security state, from the way Palestinians experience political incarceration to racist technologies of separation and apartheid from the wall in Israel to prison-like schools in the U.S., to the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. G4S brings sophisticated technologies of control to prisons in Israel, like Hasharon Prison, which includes children among its prisons, and Damon Prison, which incarcerates women as well. But I think it's important for us to recognize that it is involved in education in the U.S. as well. You know, I was impressed because I was looking at a website by the name of Great Schools, and I came across a school in Florida that is called Central Pasco Girls Academy in Land O'Lakes, Florida. This small alternative public school. But then when you look at the facilities page of the G4S website, you discover this entry, because that school belongs to G4S. Central Pasco Girls Academy serves 32 moderate risk females aged 13 to 18 who have been assessed as needing intensive mental health services. And so when you consider that the process of producing mental health has been given up entirely, and as a matter of fact, the two largest psychiatric institutions in this country are Cook County Jail in Chicago and Rikers Island in New York. G4S is involved in this girls' school, and they indicate that they use gender-specific treatment, addressing sexual abuse, substance abuse, domestic violence, trauma, and if this security company is going to be responsible for addressing issues of intimate violence and substance abuse, you can be sure that those social problems will be with us forever, because they're about reproducing them. In the UK, I learned that G4S operates rape crisis centers. Now, this is a security corporation, a corporation that owns and operates prisons all over the country, a corporation that provides transportation for immigrants who are being deported from the U.S. to Mexico. G4S also deports people in the UK to Africa, to Angola, for example. And there was the case of Jimmy Mubenga, who died a terrifying death while being restrained by G4S guards in his airplane seat. They belted and handcuffed him behind his back, and because he was talking, they used what they call the karaoke hold. They push the head of the prisoner into the seat in front of him. And they held him there for something like 40 minutes. And this took place in front of the passengers, in front of the crew, and no one intervened. By the time the ambulance service arrived, he was dead. Ademir and BDS has called upon the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to divest its $170 million stake in G4S. This egregious treatment of undocumented immigrants from the U.S. to the U.K. compels us, I think, to make connections with Palestinians who are transformed into immigrants, indeed undocumented immigrants on their own ancestral lands. Companies like G4S provide the technical means of carrying out this process. When I visited Palestine in 2011, our delegation met with many organizations, And I'll never forget when Omar Barghouti said to us, "We're not asking you to do anything extraordinary. We're not asking you to do anything heroic. We are simply asking you not to be complicit with the crimes of the state of Israel." That's the very least we can do. We also had a very interesting meeting with Queers for BDS. And of course, you're familiar with pinkwashing, right? And the attempt to represent the state of Israel as the most democratic state of the region, drawing on its connection with the U.S., but also using strategies of pinkwashing to bolster this false notion of democracy. Israel is supposed to be the best place for women and for LGBTQ communities. But of course, we have to ask, which women? There's, again, this universal category that hides racism within it. And we have to ask, which LGBTQ communities? Certainly not Palestinian. The pinkwashing effect covers over the carceral repression. And the work that Queers for BDS have done has pointed out the extent to which justice is invisible. You cannot say that you want justice for LGBTQ communities and at the same time subject Palestinians to the kind of absolute repression that is associated with the occupation of Palestine. When I described the segregation in Palestine that so clearly mirrors the historical apartheid racism in the U.S., and when I've spoken to black audiences, the response has almost inevitably been, "Why has no one told us this before? Why don't we know this? You know, why don't we know about the signs on the highways leading from, you know, one settler community to another? Why don't we know about the signs in Hebron that prevent Palestinians from walking down certain streets?" Just as we say never again with respect to the fascism that produced the Holocaust, we also need to say never again with respect to apartheid. In South Africa, of course, never again to apartheid in South Africa and in the southern U.S., but this also means first and foremost that we have to expand and deepen our solidarities with the people of Palestine who are experiencing the technologies and the practices and the regimes of apartheid inside occupied Palestine. And so we say to the people of Palestine, people of all genders, sexualities, people inside and outside prison walls, people inside and outside the wall, we say, free all Palestinian political prisoners, abolish the prison industrial complex, justice for Palestine, and yes, Palestine will be free. Thank you.
That was activist and author Angela Davis speaking at PeaceWorks 2014 at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. The title of the conference was "Yet Again as Captives, Mass Incarceration in the U.S. and Palestine." Angela Davis was preceded by activist and academic Nora Ericott. This is KBOO Portland. Time is 9:59 a.m., Coming up next, Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with your host, Chris Andre. At 10:15, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Rabia Yemin hosts The Digital Divide, analyzing how to use science, medicine, and technology to benefit society and keep it from harming us. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not currently a member, you can rectify that at kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor and broadcast live from the 2014 Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. The 27th annual festival will take place July 3rd through the 6th, 2014, at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. It will feature Greg Allman, Los Lobos, Lee Fields, and The Expressions among the 100-plus acts that will perform over the four-day festival. The 27th annual Waterfront Blues Festival will benefit the Oregon Food Bank. More information on artists, tickets, and the KBOO broadcast of the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.